My name is Bob Baker. I work here at the village. I've lived here for over a year and a half, and I expect in the next 2 to 4 months to be moving to the next position, but I don't know where that is yet. I was invited up for 2 years.
Did you say you were a master?
Did I say that?
No.
What?
What
I didn't say that.
Psychologist? From the title of your talk.
Oh. Well, I'm going to find out what you know about the title of my talk, or what you think of it. You might know more about it than I do. Well, the one is rather odd. It's just alone in the universe, or hanging on a mobile. Now, how many were here yesterday at 4 o'clock for Jackie's session on alcoholism? And she actually had one hanging over here. I was going to ask her to just leave it. That was kind of nice. It's she had a very colorful one.
What?
A mobile. It was hanging on a string right here, and just now, so all the rest of you can picture one now. Just imagine there's a string that comes down, and now there's this stick that goes across here, and then there's a string that comes down on this end. It's pretty close over here. It's a little further from the end, and it hangs down, and then there's some more sticks with pieces hanging on it. It's a whole complex, and there are as many pieces hanging on that. This is the first clue. As in your family. For you, that is.
But when I read that title, I was thinking of the mobile that you hook on the back of an automobile, you know.
So you had to come to this session for travel tips. Well, I was a little concerned about that, so there's a series. This is the first of three sessions, and there's a series title. They didn't put it on the board, so this afternoon I added that to the board. The series title is Self-Identity and Relationships, which maybe says more. I mean, that communicates more about what the topic is. So let me ask a couple of questions here. The first one is, when you think of self-identity, what do you think of? In very general terms, it's wide open.
Just of who I am.
Okay, who I am. That's good. Anyone else?
A child of God.
A child of God, all right.
Family system.
I think somebody should be up here talking about this. Family systems. Okay, who else? What else do you think of? Self-identity.
What my values are.
What your values are, that's good. What you believe in. Okay, that's a general expression, and you said child of God, which carries some of that in a particular way. Good. Well, how do you think... Now that's answering it right now, but let's say 30 years ago, 40 years ago, or even more, if somebody were to talk about self-identity, what might have been just
who they are in relationship to other people?
Well,
other family
members? That's right, you could say family. That's interesting. Okay, I'm glad to hear that because, see, that just proves I don't have all the right answers.
Family-oriented, huh?
Yeah, that's how you look at it. Well, okay, I think that may not be where we were, say, professionally, and in theory. Pardon?
You identify with your job.
Yeah, people identify with their job.
That's a good one.
Or your husband.
Or your spouse. Okay?
That's good.
If you were to go get some counseling help, say, 50 years ago, what do you think, who would have gone? You know, and what might have happened?
Anybody have any experience 50 years ago with that?
It wasn't very many.
There weren't many. Okay, typically I think, now I'm going to kind of simplify things for purposes of illustration. This isn't exactly what, I'm no expert about 50 years ago. But let's say about then, if you were to go for some help, to get some help with a problem, whatever that was, but if it has to do with psychology, the typical model would be the psychiatrist, medical doctor who studied psychology and counseling and psychiatry. And the psychiatrist would talk to you as an individual. In fact, the psychiatrist, I suspect, would so much focus on the individual that, you know, the psychiatric couch, the Freudian couch,
Sigmund Freud,
where does the psychiatrist sit in during the counseling session?
In the
back of you, above your head and out of sight. Mm-hmm. Out of sight so that the psychiatrist doesn't contaminate the process. Which is a way of saying the focus is on the isolated individual. Now that doesn't mean there was no reference to other members of the family, etc. But that's where the counseling model was, and for some still is. In the late 1940s, there was developed what's called systems theory. This is our first few minutes about methodology. Every class session, we've got to have a couple of introductory minutes about methodology. Probably the most boring part, but it gets us to where we're going to go. At least it launches us in a direction. In the late 40s in physics, there was much study about systems theory and how particles interacted with other particles in some kind of a context. So you don't look just at an isolated particle. And that spread into the field of economics, and it spread into other fields, it spread into counseling, and it got caught in the area of counseling in a strong sense in the 60s. And so people started, who said relationships over here earlier? You know, people started looking at individuals in the context of a relationship. So one area of research that really blossomed in the 60s is what causes schizophrenia? And so then some researchers went and looked at people in relationships. In particular, they looked at people in families. They started studying a family and how the members of a family talk to each other, how they interact, how they relate, and to see if there's some clue in that, if there's something that's common amongst all these families in which there's a schizophrenic member.
You might be interested to know that my son is schizophrenic.
You'd be interested.
I have a young son who's schizophrenic.
Okay. So, and you and I might talk about that after this session.
Yeah,
let's see what turns up here.
Schizophrenic.
Okay, schizophrenic is a psychological disorder, and most simply put, it's where a person, let's say, is not in touch with what you and I call reality in a consistent way. And a stereotype image is, well, at one time they act one way and another time they act as though they were a different person. Some people call it split personality. That's a manifestation of it. So in the 60s, people started looking at a system. And so the gentleman over here that talked about an individual in the context of family systems is right on target with the kind of thing that I am interested in pursuing this evening. So already you get an answer to the title, Alone in the Universe, and that's kind of the person on the Freudian couch, or hanging on a mobile. And that's what I want to pursue. You think of a mobile over here, well, we'll draw one up here. And you think of the family, the members in your family as hanging together, somehow interrelated. So for starters, now, what do you suppose we have here?
Upside down.
It looks upside down. A mobile would be the other way, wouldn't it? Okay, well, here's a person, and this is the left-hand side. So this person's male, and this is female. The line down here means they got married. And as long as they stay married, we won't go like this. But if they get divorced, you make a little notation like that. So there's a special little notation we'll use, and there's no secret about it. So if you have any kind of question, then you can ask me. Now,
kids.
Yeah, right. There they got some children. It's upside down because the whole business moves from top to bottom. That is, this person existed, and then they got married, and then they had children. And it also moves from left to right, meaning this is the oldest, and this is the youngest. And we could put various notations up here, like 2 years, 2 years, 5 years. And that's the span of time between birth. Well, there's all kinds of notes that we could put up here. But what I want to talk about specifically this evening is the matter of roles and rituals, if we get that far. And tomorrow, the session I have will deal with rules. I was trying to think of what time the session was, and then I wrote the wrong word. I have trouble chewing gum and crossing the street, too. Okay, when you look at a family, what are some of the roles that you think of?
Father and mother.
Okay, and what might the father do? What's a fatherly role?
Provide the living and take care of the whole family.
Okay.
Provider.
Provider, earn the income.
Yeah.
And then what did you say?
Provider and the mother provide comfort and taking care of everything.
Okay, this is comfort, care. Chalkboards were nailed to the wall, they were standing.
That's what it used to be, not anymore.
That's okay. She says the roles are changing. Some roles are changing. Well, that's all right. We'll just put some roles up here. But it doesn't matter. I mean, there's not a right or wrong answer. Just what do you experience? What's a father's role?
Direction.
Head of the household?
Enforce discipline.
Discipline?
What do you mean by head of the household?
She wants to know, what do you mean by who wears the pants in the family? Okay, there's a variety. Let's shift down here to children. This one's I think it starts to get a little more interesting. Let's deal with this youngster here.
Well, the oldest one has to take a little care of the younger one.
Okay. How many agree with that? How many have experienced that or observed it? Okay, let's say this person is a caregiver. I don't mean that's all they do, but that's part of the role of being the oldest one as we experience it in many families. What else? What else do you think of as... How many oldest children do we have here?
Responsibility. Yeah, they sure get it.
More responsibility.
Set an example.
High achievers.
Responsible, set example, high achiever.
She's a gopher.
What? A gopher? Did somebody say?
I said a gopher. She's the one that has to go for. Go for.
That's right. I just wanted to check out if I heard you right. Yeah. Let's see. How do you spell that? Gopher, isn't it?
That's right.
Gopher.
Gopher.
For what?
Well, for whatever you're sent for. You go for this, go get me that, go get this, help me with that, hand me the hammer.
Well, my oldest grandniece taught her sister that was 2 years younger. She was my oldest niece, is, I would say, a brain, but she taught her youngest niece how to read and to write and everything so that when she started school, she knew.
Yes. So she was a caregiver, a helper, an assister, and acted in a responsible way. Okay, what about the person down here, the other end?
Baby.
This is the baby?
Baby. Spoiled.
Spoiled?
He's bossed a lot.
Bossed around. How many youngest ones have we got here? Okay.
In our family, he was called the caboose.
Okay, the caboose, the tail end. All right. What about these two over here?
Mediators.
Oh, that's sharp. You bet. I've sure seen that. A mediator. This is the one who comes in and arbitrates disputes. They're literally caught in the middle. You know, this person up here is usually stronger, and this person over here gets their way. So this one has to learn how to negotiate. Yeah, what's some other feature of the...
Choose
out of hand-me-downs. Hand-me-downs.
They have to wear what the older ones had.
And then what happens when you get down to the youngest one?
They're
worn out, and they get brand new ones, and that's why they're spoiled. Well, some of them still get the hand up, that's right. Okay, that sort of difference depends on the whole business here. Okay, so we're starting to talk a little bit about birth order in this family system. And at this point, I want to, before I forget, because I usually forget, I'll tell you about a couple of books. And some of these we just put on the reserve shelf in the library, so if you want to pursue it, some of it's there. This kind of a way of looking at a family, and we're just getting started, because think of this person not as father, but as child. So now there's a... This person is connected to a line up here, and we haven't said whether they're the oldest or the youngest or in between. You know, and then this man's parents and where they fit in, And later on, when people here get married, if they do, then, you know, the pattern continues. That whole business is called a genogram. So if you were to look in a bookstore, family systems is one section or title, but the whole business of genograms, genealogy, mapping it out. And you can find books that just talk about how you do it. What we've just dealt with here in terms of sibling birth order, well, this is very introductory. It has to do with whether this person's male or female. The characteristics will differ. They will differ whether this person's male or female, and or whether this is a female and the other three are boys. In all those different patterns, you get somebody like Walter Tolman, who wrote a book called Family Constellations. And you can look up, it's sort of a cookbook. You can look up in here where you are and what your family's like. And he says, well, this is the characteristic of a person like that. And you might think, well, how do you know that? You didn't come to our place. But it's not universally true for absolutely everybody. But the tendency, there's some very strong patterns which in our culture keep getting repeated. Now, what we did, for example, I'll do something with this. We said this person's a caregiver. We didn't say it, but we could have, that this person receives care. You know, people take care of the youngest one, provide for, help them out, and this person tends to be the help giver. Well, that may describe families, how they are, but the question is, if you want to define, well, what's a healthy person, or what's a healthy family, how should they be? Well, what would you say? What do you think about this person here? Are they as healthy as they really should be?
Not always.
What might be different? Just in the terms that we talked about right here.
Well, I think the oldest one shouldn't really have so much responsibility because then they get to be more serious individuals, and the younger one is more fun-loving because he hasn't had to be so responsible.
That's good. That wasn't what I had in mind, but that's maybe even better. I like that. Thank you.
Well, I think you relax more with each child, too, mm-hmm. because you try so hard with the first one.
Sure. So you're talking about the parents.
Yeah.
How they relate with the youngsters. And so that's going to influence how the youngsters view themselves. Mm-hmm. Well, we've got somebody here named Beavers, who he calls this psychotherapy and growth, a family systems perspective. There's that terminology. And Beavers says, have you ever tried to give somebody, an oldest child, a gift? Have you ever tried to do something for them? And what kind of response do you get back?
No, thank you.
No, thank you. Or they've got to return the favor the next day, at the latest, with a little bit added to it.
Yeah.
Caregivers have a great deal of difficulty accepting or receiving care.
They've gotten in some real big arguments.
Yeah. And have you ever tried to get the youngest to help out? Who said pulling teeth was hardest to do?
Well, sometimes they're stricter with the first one.
Pardon?
The parents are stricter with the first
one.
Yes.
And so the self-identity that this person took on, a lot of it was what was expected of them and how the parents related to them. And so that's been pointed out. Parents tend to be more serious, you know. Well, this is the only child around. So they get more of the parents' time. And then by the time you've got 7 or 8 siblings down there, you know, it's really diluted. It all changes. So self-identity is really not, I don't believe, acquired in what I construed as the Freudian model. It's, you know, it doesn't develop alone in the universe. It's not just me, myself, and I. The whole business is more like a mobile. And
another thing, sometimes the oldest, I happen to be a girl, and I think my dad wanted a boy, and that makes a lot of difference too.
Sure.
On how he treats you.
Oh, you bet it does.
Well, then the girl becomes a tomboy.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Oh, there's lots of things. What do you suppose this 5 here might mean?
Unplanned.
I mean, we're just going to be real hypothetical. Pardon?
Unplanned.
Unplanned. And how might this person, you know, instead of saying unplanned, what might this person say of themselves? Did somebody say it? Unwanted. Can you imagine what a label like that is for someone's self-identity? Mm-hmm. I was unwanted. Or this is a little different. Let's say this is, they got married June 15th, let's just say 1940. This person over here was born October 3rd, 1940. Well, how does that impact this person's self-identity?
They don't tell.
But eventually, okay, we're not saying that this particular situation impacts this person over here or everybody exactly the same all the time. Already we're starting to surface the fact that there are so many variables that no two family mobiles are identical. But I want to underscore that point and sort of throw a teaser out that we'll get to more fully, I suspect, tomorrow as I look at my watch. Here is a family right here. Now there's one over here. You have to imagine this one. But the question is, when somebody from over here marries somebody from over here, what do you suppose happens then?
Same thing.
Yeah, well, let's focus on the two who are getting married. You know, what kind of expectations does this person bring with them? Well, it comes out of how this family functioned. And what kind of expectations does this person bring? And if two families are not identical,
it would depend upon if the oldest one over here maybe marries the youngest one over there.
Have you been reading these books before?
That's what happens.
This is what
happens.
This is my baby.
Well, okay. Why do you suppose the oldest might of this family might marry the youngest of this family?
Because he's a caregiver. He's a caregiver.
Yeah. Okay, he was a caregiver. And the other is a care receiver. Is that a good match?
Sure is.
Oh, that's comfortable. There are roles. And the role expectation that this person has and the role expectation that this person has matches. Mm-hmm. Now, I won't ask which is which, okay? Because otherwise I couldn't say it with the next thing I want to point out.
Well,
what happens when...
We stuck it out for 45 years so it didn't make anything.
Okay.
Stuck it out.
The man likes to have to say, you don't cook like my mother did.
I can't keep up with this group. You're going to teach each other. I'm going to be up here facilitating. I like that illustration. I really do.
I know what you're going to say, too.
Let me back up for a minute. This person here, did I have her? Yeah. This person here is the youngest of a sibling group, this man, okay? You see how that's diagrammed? This gal over here is the oldest. That's the illustration we're using right now. Okay. So she is a caregiver, and he gladly receives it. Very comfortable with that. Very used to that. In fact, expects it. Now, what do you suppose might happen when, 22 years later, these down here, these four, are grown up and moved away from home. What do you expect she might say? I'll fill it in a little more. She's going to a counselor for help. What might be the complaint?
Always doing something for somebody. Not enough to do. She doesn't get any help. Uh-huh. She's lonesome.
Okay, well, that might be the case. That.
Empty nest syndrome
might be a pop-up presenting problem.
She
no longer has a care receiver.
He's too dependent.
Yeah.
She wants to be taken
care of. Well, that's interesting. Well, we've got a real diversity of responses, so I think there's a real diversity of experiences. What I've heard most frequently, and I'm not saying that means it's most frequently, but this person comes in rather tired. Mm-hmm.
and says, I've been raising 5 children for 25 years, and one of them refuses to grow up. The oldest one. This one. And it comes to a point in time when I've heard this person, frequently I've heard this person say, I really am tired of giving and giving and giving, and I really now would like a partner instead of another child. So, the issue then that I'm presenting is what started out as a good basis for a marriage relationship had some problems in the long run, and Beavers is saying one of the reasons might be that this person really needed to learn to give some, and this person needs to learn to receive, and that's a more stable and more enduring, and Beaver says, healthier relationship. Well, you see, I put that healthier in quote marks because who's in charge of the definition? And then we get into this business of values that the two of you, you raised it specifically and you suggested as child of God. Well, who defines health and who defines well-being and who defines how it ought to be? Well, that's a little bit about roles and where we are in the family. You touched on an interesting thing in terms of marriage, but I'm going to hold that one off a little bit about a fellow marrying his mother, so to speak. Because that's going to come in with rules a little more. Rituals is the next thing I want to spend some time on. I think that's a fun one. All of this is just an introduction to this hanging on a mobile business. One way of getting at a family or understanding how a family operates and thereby learning something about oneself is sayings in the family. So I'm going to ask you, what are some things that you grew up with hearing all the time? And maybe you've even repeated it yourself. You know, it wasn't too long ago, I asked one of our daughters to do something and to kind of hurry up about it. And she snapped back, don't rush me and I'll work cheaper. Well, I'd sort of forgotten that. But she'd been around my dad for a while. That's where she picked it up.
Don't rush me, what?
Don't rush me, and I'll work cheaper.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, and others like, if you're going to do it right. You've heard that one before?
Yeah.
Now, that's a saying. What kind of a label would you put with a person who says that kind of thing? What might you say? A perfectionist. Sure. So let's say one of these down here is a perfectionist and maybe the oldest. And one of the sayings in his family is, if you're going to do it at all, if you're going to do it right. If it's worth doing right. And there's variations on the same thing. So self-identity was impacted in several little ways. Some of them are humorous, but family sayings.
Well, my stepmother used to say that, well, you have to eat so much dirt before you die. But she was a very clean person, so she didn't plan to die very early, because, boy, everything was spotless.
Well, okay.
That was a favorite saying of hers. You have to eat so much dirt before you die, she'd tell me.
You have to eat so much dirt before you die.
She didn't plan to die very early, I know it.
Yeah, well.
I was her helper. I had to do the dusting, and after I dusted, she went around all over.
Checked it out. What do you think she meant by you have to eat so much dirt before you die? What was the message that
you... I heard that, but I don't know any particular.
What message did you experience?
I just thought it was just a saying she had quite a few, but that sticks in my mind.
That one told you that, well, the dusting needs to be done, so you might as well do it.
Oh, I was kind of a... trial to her, I think. I loved to read. When she'd have me dust, I tried to have a book dumped someplace. So can you imagine, I tried to dust and read at the same time.
What you don't have in your head, you have to have in your feet.
What you don't have in your head,
you have to have in your feet.
You have to have
in your
feet.
Well, you could turn it around. You could say, if you don't use your head,
you
have to use your
feet. If you don't use your head, you have to use your Now, what might a parent be saying when they use that expression to one of the children?
If you don't use your head, you have to use your feet.
Think.
So,
think.
Okay, so think.
Think before you act.
Think before you act.
If you're going down to the cellar to get a pound of butter, bring up the milk and maybe something else. And
okay.
Do it all at once, and that's using your head instead of your feet.
Kill two birds with one stone. Yeah.
Sometimes when you do that, you forgot what you went down there for.
Well, I mean, you've had that experience. Sounds like everybody. When you said that, I was thinking, all right, it's time to do your homework, and you better do it now, because when you're out of school, if you didn't use your head now, you're going to wind up using your feet. And so that comes across variously.
My mother would say, be observant.
Be observant.
Yep. Notice things.
Notice things. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Very much ask me what I see and notice.
So you really develop your peripheral vision and recognize things and take note of it. Mm-hmm.
Good.
My mother.
Is your mother a journalist?
No.
let's get your homework done before you just play.
Okay. Yeah. Homework has to be done and then play.
My mother had a fancy work store, and she said, finish the article that you started before you start something else. If you're embroidering,
you're working on a project.
You know, finish the product that you're working on. Don't drop that and start something else.
Yeah.
Finish what you're starting before you go into something else.
Now, how many times do you think you heard that while you were growing up?
Quite a few.
Do you do it that way?
Well, when she'd say so.
Okay, all right.
My husband used to say you have to finish the old jam before you can open up a nice new jar. Now he's gone and I just love to have more than one on the table.
Mary reminds me. Connie, what was it your mother was chewing gum?
I don't know what you're thinking
about. Oh, your mom was cracking gum.
My mother always said, don't play with your chewing gum like this stuff or pop it. So one time after I was pretty old in high school or college, I caught her doing that. I said, you never let me do that. She says, well, now you're all grown up, I can have fun too.
So sometimes parents don't practice what they preach, or we're all. All right, that's just a quick, Ellis, go ahead.
Well, it just seems to me that so many times as adults we do things, and the main reason we're doing them is in spite of what we were always told in our childhood. Our behaviors, when you really look at them, they're just kind of getting back, you know.
Yeah,
good. That touches on an important thing. What I've been saying in part up to this point is that what these children down here learn about themselves, about relating with people, is learned for the most part from the role model that the parents set. But sometimes it's different. Sometimes a child or children of alcoholics are teetotalers. And frequently children of Republicans or Democrats or the other way around. You know, so it's not at all infrequent that children turn out the opposite. Well, the question is, are they really the opposite? It looks like independent behavior, this rebelliousness. I'm going to do it differently. But the it is still in charge. The it of politics, or the it of alcohol, or the it of smoking, or the it of, you name it. Pardon?
Nothing.
That item is still in charge, so it's not really independent behavior. Independent in the sense that the child is facing a whole open set of values or opportunities and really freely choosing. Their choice is still keyed to what was a dominant feature in the family that they grew up in.
Yeah, it becomes ingrained in their... Mm-hmm.
Yes. So what that does is, again, it tilts it. We're not alone in the universe. We are part of a system, a very complex system, and our self-identity and the way we think and the way we behave is very much influenced by that system. This lady here.
I have a friend whose husband died, and the son, he just grieved so terrible. He was just like a different person. Now, how do they treat that? How would you?
Oh.
When the father suddenly died.
Yeah.
And he was about 13 or 14, and he just, she had an awful hard time with him.
Yeah.
He felt mad because he felt like his father left him or something like that.
Yeah. That's a very difficult time in life, 13, 14 years old. And, I mean, without anything else happening in the family, there's just so much bouncing around inside of a person that it's a difficult time. And then introduce something like the death of a parent.
Yeah.
And, but it would be very presumptuous of me to say, well, this is how to treat this or that. Because, see, I think the family system is such an important way of viewing it that I would need to know a whole lot of particulars about the family system.
Mm-hmm.
And then facilitate that system taking care of it. Now, sir?
Well, I was just going to add a little bit to what I think has been referred to here. I think the kids a lot of times are, we know they go through rebellious periods, but I think a lot of times when they have grown up and so forth, and they've established their own identity and so forth. I think really what's happened, they've selected the strong points from from their parents in some cases. And in other cases, they say, Dad had a weak point here. He wasn't religious enough, you know, and we're going to change that. So in certain ways, they'll make those adjustments. It's like a fine tuning.
Yeah.
And they have elements of the parents' behavior, but they have made corrections as they see it, so forth in their life.
Yeah. And that inner, go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say, they do certainly do copy a lot, because when my boys left home, they both left home at the same time, and I was kind of amused when I went over to their residence the first time, and they had painted the kitchen the same color as what we had at home. I thought it was kind of funny.
Sure, almost predictable, go ahead.
It really makes me wonder if we have any free choice about what we do. Are we destined to either be exactly like our parents or to rebel and be the opposite of our parents?
Aren't there other things that affect a person besides parents?
Sure.
Oh, sure.
That's just one part of our person that helps the person.
That's right. So we're not destined to be carbon copies or the opposite. So.
One more question. Why sometimes is there a bad apple in the family?
Why a bad apple?
I think I could answer that.
And those, because we had one in our block. And it wasn't the parents. Those kids had the same parents. There was one out of four. And I think, in that instance, that child's peers influenced him more than his parents did.
That's true. Yeah. But I just want.
Let me plug a couple more books on the reference shelf in the library. This book is a easy reading, fun reading book in a sense. I mean, my experience was I sat down, I started reading it, and I didn't finish till I finished. The Family Crucible, The Intensive Experience of Family Therapy. Now, the well-known name here, Carl Whitaker, is a notorious type fellow in family systems. He does some rather drastic things, and that of course makes for an interesting type book. But the book is a narrative with a lot of dialogue in it of a family who had a problem child, and they went to the counselor for help. And there were two counselors in this case, and it's the assisting counselor, Ernest Napier, who wrote the book. And so that's a good introduction to a family system. You kind of peek in on somebody, listen to what was going on. And it deals with that presenting problem. But some of this other business of how people relate, this book is on the shelf, People Making by Virginia Satir. She has several books on it. She's still writing books. Conjoint Family Therapy is a book that has something to do with roles in relationships. There's the accuser, you know, the blamer, and the martyrs. Well, there's various sets of roles that you can get into. Maybe I should say this one. It's sold out in the bookstore at the moment, but you could do me a favor if you go to the bookstore and ask for it. Ask the bookstore manager for it, because I don't think she's reordered it yet.
Family Ties That Bind.
It's by Ron Richardson. I really want to plug this book because of all the books, this is the easiest one to get into the whole business about. It's written for the non-technical person. There are no footnotes, there's no bibliography. Ron has taken a lot of academic literature, all this other kind of stuff over here, and he's distilled it down well, and he wrote a book. And the nice thing is that when he got to writing it, his wife rewrote it. Well, he's a psychologist, so he gave a good content, but she's a journalist, so it reads well. In fact, it's a delight to read. So it's available in places like the University of Washington bookstore in Seattle, for example, but if you ask the bookstore manager, that will help her remember to order another 10 copies.
If you like your parents, I know it myself, some of the things that as a teenager that my peers did, I would like to have done, but I knew it would hurt my mother, and I wouldn't do anything that would hurt my parents.
Yeah.
So I refrained from doing it.
Okay. Let's say that what you're talking about, and I'll back it off and make it just kind of general terms, is that this child here and what they do or what they avoid doing is highly influenced by this person's attitudes and how the behavior might impact or does impact this person. Now, if this person sets out to design it that way in a very controlling, manipulative sort of way, one way of describing this relationship is enmeshment. I mean, they're not only close, but this person's self-identity is really linked in with this person's identity and value system. So that except for the fact there really are two bodies walking around, in some ways it's hard to tell there's two. That's enmeshment. And the opposite of that would be a youngster here who is cut off from a parent or a sibling, or it could be any person, but we're specifically talking about the family. Now, to get to your question a little more concretely, we'd say, for purposes of illustration, this person's a carbon copy. And this person is, down here is the rebel. I mean, they're just doing things so opposite, they're having nothing to do with this person up here. Now, what would you say is the case? Who's in charge of their self-identity down here? I realize that's sort of simplistic to say, but in 30 minutes or 60 minutes, he's got it.
That child could be cut off from the parent, but in a lot of respects, he will still do the very same thing as that parent that he's rebelling against.
Yes. So the identity and the behavior patterns are still very much, in both cases, coming from the parent model. Yes. Now, what would you say is necessary for this individual down here, either one, to be their own person?
I don't think that one wants to, because that's mama's girl or mama's baby or something, yeah. So that's what they want to be, and the other kids are jealous of that because they know.
Like teacher's pet and that sort of thing? Okay, yeah. Well, okay, this person might not want to be. We really have to ask them to find out. But let's assume this person really is to be their own person or a separate person. How would they do it? How would they go about it?
When they leave, when they're 18 years old, and leave the household and go out on their own.
That doesn't always work. It doesn't work.
They
grow up.
Yeah, pardon?
They have a hard time adjusting to growing up because they've been so dependent on
them. Oh, no. After graduation and you get a job, you can have your own apartment, see?
Well, that's not the point.
But
there was a family that I met with. And this is mother, father, and four children, and one child obviously is different than the rest of the family, by a teenager, by the way they dress, by their mannerisms, you know. And anyway, to make a long thing short, the conflict was, the basic conflict was between I'm still wording it wrong, but the obvious conflict was between the daughter and the mother. Now, this mother was herself a daughter who'd had enormous difficulty with her mother.
You heard it coming, huh?
Well, I met these people in the western part of the United States, and I want Joelle to talk to say that the grandmother, you know, that's the back up here, this mother's mother, this lady lived in rural northern Norway, okay? And she left the country to get away from her mother, with whom she had so much conflict. And now, you know, where I experienced it was a conflict between here and here. But I maintain that this conflict, you know, this relationship, the tension in it, which is usually illustrated this way, this conflict was just a continuation of this conflict because this had never gotten resolved. So the point of family systems, and this continues to bring us, you asked a powerful question, brings us back to that question. When somebody grows up and leaves home, I should put that in quote marks too, leaves home and gets married, and has a spouse and children, are they really going to be able to have good relationships, healthy relationships, satisfying relationships, just because they left home?
No, sir.
No. Because they left home how?
Well, they were probably still dependent and still being the recipient of a lot of gifts.
Yeah.
And if they don't marry somebody that can take care of them, they're going to expect gifts, because I know somebody just like it.
They left home physically, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. but not emotionally. Mm-hmm. Not in terms of the dynamics of
but
how they relate with people.
But they can't live together either. That's another thing. That mother and daughter can't live together. That never works.
Well.
Not always.
Yeah, we wouldn't want to say never.
You'd put me out of business.
I used to I want to stand on my own 2 feet. I used to say that all the time. I want to stand on my own 2 feet.
I want to stand on my own 2 feet. And I think you can. I mean, I want to hold out hope, okay? But the approach of family systems, or in this book as they talk about family of origin therapy, that's how Richardson wants to refer to it, is when this situation comes in, one of the places to focus for work is back here. Because for this person, this is her family of origin. This is the original family that she grew up in, just as for this individual, this is her family of origin, or the original family that she grew up in. And when you and I can relate well with the people in our family of origin, we will have learned how to relate well with other people. We will have learned how to stand on our own 2 feet, how not to be just a carbon copy or a simple knee-jerk rebel. We identify our own needs, we identify our own talents, our own abilities, so that, you know, this is Franklin the fourth, and this is Franklin the sixth, and this Franklin was a, you name it, an attorney, a medical doctor, a salesman, and the expectation this Franklin would be too, and you know, so you've got a string of, how many people know about, you know, my dad was a pastor, his dad was a pastor, his dad was a pastor, or some other occupation like that? You know, so the occupations, or even going to college, was a family decision made for the individual. Well, there's still a lot of enmeshment in that kind of a system. So family of origin, and I'll come back to this on Saturday in the session to how to say what you mean and mean what you say. Because that kind of conversational patterns enables people to differentiate, to be born again, but this time to be born from the family, to help for that birth of launching out on their own. Otherwise, it's just like you were indicating. Let's see. I'm going to draw, let's say this gal in her relationship with her father, I'm going to say they had some tension and some difficulty. And what do you suppose happens when she marries this fellow?
Transfers
it to him. Yes. This is the significant male figure in her life. For 18, 19, 20, or whatever it is, it is the significant person with whom she relates as a female, as a woman. And if there's some unfinished business in this relationship, and she goes out and marries somebody similar, and you know why, because the pattern is predictable. It's like the abused spouse who stays in the household instead of getting away from it, stays there. It's painful, but it's more painful to be in a situation that you don't understand, in an environment that's unpredictable, it's unfamiliar. I hate unfamiliar places. New jobs, new locations, there's so much work because I don't know what to expect. And so it's more comfortable with what I expect. And I find myself in a comfortable relationship with somebody who behaves like I think they're supposed to behave. You know? And people get married that way. I mean, that's one of the big factors of selecting a spouse. But when there's unfinished business, it's exactly like you said, Mark. That gets transferred over here. Now I ask you, can this individual solve, in this relationship, problems that come out of this relationship?
You have to talk it over.
Oh, more than talk it over. It just doesn't happen. But the solving of the problem over here really opens up for the possibility of a better relationship over here. So a key, a critical key, I'm not saying it's the only way in the world people can function, but I find this stuff to be a powerful tool. The key for over here is exploring this one back here and getting it talked out and worked out so that some differentiation, they're no longer enmeshed or a knee-jerk rebellion. Okay. Well, the proposal for tomorrow, we have to stop now for Vesper, but the proposal for tomorrow is to follow this family systems or how life hangs on the mobile in terms of, we'll get some more about rituals, but rules. And they continue exploring that in its most interesting manifestation that I experience or have fun with. And that's how a person from one family marries somebody from another family where things were done differently and so the expectations are different. Good.
I thought you were talking about my family when you mentioned
normally. Okay, thank you for today.
Thank you.